Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the homeland security and national security implications of what is described as the worst natural disaster in American history in New Orleans and surrounding Mississippi and Alabama. We'll be talking in a moment with P.J. Crowley, who's a senior fellow and director of national defense and homeland security at the Center for American Progress. Previously, P.J. Crowley was a special assistant to the President of the United States, Bill Clinton, for national security affairs, serving as a senior director for public affairs at the National Security Council. He spent over 26 years in the United States Air Force, retiring as the rank of colonel, and the last 11 years in the Pentagon and three in the White House. He'll be talking to us in a moment. We'll also talk about whether or not this was a natural or a man-made disaster. We'll be talking with Dr. Ari Kelman, who is a professor of history at the University of California, Davis. He's the author of A River and Its City, The Nature of Landscape in New Orleans. And we'll also be joined by Steve Clements, who's a publisher of the popular political blog, thewashingtonnote.com. And he is putting on a conference beginning on Tuesday of this week, which will be broadcast on C-SPAN in Washington, D.C., Terrorism, Security, and America's Purpose. So I'll be talking to him about both the disaster and what he plans to talk about at this conference on the broader issues of the war on terrorism. I'm speaking with Philip P.J. Crowley, who's a senior fellow and director of national defense at the and homeland security at the Center for American Progress. And previously, P.J. Crowley was a special assistant to President Bill Clinton for national security affairs, serving as the senior director of public affairs at the National Security Council, and spent 26 years in the United States Air Force, retiring as a rank of colonel. And P.J. Crowley, in terms of the homeland security and the national security implications of the disaster down there, I mean, it's not hard to make the connection, and I'm sure many people have done, that here we are overseas, particularly in the Middle East, trying to bring democracy, stability, in effect, repairing potholes in Baghdad, and we've got a city in our own country underwater. Do you think that kind of connection is being made in the minds of a lot of Americans? In other words, why are we helping these people in the Middle East who don't seem to be particularly grateful? In fact, they're shooting our boys and girls. And why don't we take care of our own?
Well, I certainly think that around the world, people are looking at these pictures and saying, you know, this is America. without necessarily knowing a whole lot about New Orleans. I think first, as we start this conversation, it is important to recognize that this is a worst-case scenario. This is something that is an incredible, you know, double whammy in the sense of storm and flood. Although, at the same token, it was not unanticipated. I think that is the key element, which is, you know, serious mistakes or missed opportunities both before the storm and the flood arrived and immediately afterwards. I think in the broader context, it is sobering for us because while we have done a great deal in the 4 years since 9/11, recognizing that we could have man-made disasters that are every bit as difficult as natural disasters, you know, clearly what we're seeing here, hard as it is that we have an enormous amount of work to do.
But there's been a number of news stories suggesting, P.J. Crowley, that in fact the Bush administration has cherry-picked and raided FEMA funds and Army Corps of Engineers funds in order to fund Homeland Security. And what do we get for Homeland Security? I mean, apart from the color code, I'm not sure what this billion-dollar operation is bringing us.
Well, I certainly think that in the understandable focus on terrorism and counterterrorism over the past 4 years, the capabilities of FEMA to do their primary mission, which is disaster relief and recovery, has eroded. No question about it. And certainly, we see that because we have, you know, far-flung operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, even though they're textbook operations in the sense that the Army goes to war and the National Guard, you know, is its combat reserve, There are clearly stresses that are evident here that because Louisiana and Mississippi were without a substantial number of troops, that their ability to respond rapidly after the storm and after the flooding was handicapped. And I think going forward, this is really the core things. I think Homeland Security is a underfunded and heavily stressed organization. Remember, the key to the establishment of the Department of Homeland Security was that it would be formed within existing resources. And at a time of war, we're obviously also seeing, unprecedented disasters. I think we have to take a step back and look at Homeland Security and recognize that it does not have the personnel, the resources, or the structure necessary to be able to do the myriad of responsibilities that it has.
But it does seem that if you to assume, which I guess we have to, that the focus, which I believe is the focus of Homeland Security, at least it's what the administration keeps telling us, that they are trying to prevent a terrorist attack and searching out terrorist cells in this country, and that is their focus, is a security focus. What about the security of a city like New Orleans, where we know that many, many scenarios were run recently suggesting that the dikes were inadequate? So I'm just trying to get an understanding of, do we really have a broad definition? I know throughout the Cold War we had a very narrow definition of national security. It didn't sort of include our economic, cultural strength. It's been mostly focused on military, and in the case of the Cold War, on how many nuclear warheads we had. So are we still in that kind of, are we counting the wrong assets, in other words, or do we have the wrong focus, or we're not a broad enough focus?
Well, I don't think we have necessarily the wrong focus, because, we're talking about disasters, and in this particular case, disaster was natural, and in many respects, natural disasters are at least easier to deal with because you have some warning. But clearly today we have 200,000 displaced citizens within our country. And in a terrorism context where you might have a radiological device or a more likely a biological or chemical device in a major metropolitan area, you could easily envision a scenario where we would be dealing with 200,000 or more displaced persons in a terrorism context. And so, what FEMA is responsible for doing here in both getting people out of the disaster area, getting them in a temporary shelter, and then as we look forward, we're thinking that finally, things are getting better in New Orleans, and to some extent they are, but we have an enormous amount of work in front of us to reintegrate these citizens into new, semi-permanent housing, getting their kids in school, finding employment opportunities, for these people. Certainly the Astrodome as the Superdome is not the answer. Even three ships full of people is not the answer. We have an enormous amount of work to do, and this would be expressly the kind of thing that we'd be required to do in a terrorism context, and it's even more important in a terrorism context because, economic damage and societal damage is precisely what Al-Qaeda and like organizations are trying to inflict on the United States. And our ability to keep the economic impact manageable, our ability to move past the disaster and get back on our feet quickly, that's really the difference between whether at the end of the day we win or lose the so-called war on terror.
So in other words, P.J. Crowley, if, for example, there were a tip-off that there was a nuclear car bomb in an American city, would we do better? And if that were the scenario, based upon what happened in New Orleans, the people in the white suburbs would get on the freeways and get out of town, and the people in the inner city would be, in the bullseye.
Oh, absolutely. I think that is clearly one of the lessons learned here is that, first of all, in any of those tabletop exercises that we've run on mass disaster scenarios, we've basically failed them all. And again, recognize that this is hard, but ultimately we have to find an answer to this problem. But I think what we clearly recognize coming out of New Orleans is that because most major cities would have an underclass, those who are living at or below the poverty level. Any kind of evacuation order is going to have to be accompanied by substantial government resources to be able to help those that cannot help themselves to get out of harm's way. And that certainly those who know New Orleans, you know, certainly recognize that this is not a surprise in that sense, which I think goes back to the lost opportunity both prior to the arrival of the storm, where once the evacuation order was given, there really was no federal backup here to help state and local officials help their citizens move. And then once people declared that the Superdome or the Convention Center was going to be, you know, the interim shelter, there was no move to be able to stock it with food, water, and probably most importantly, porta-potties, so that people could sustain an existence there for multiple days before the broad disaster relief caught up.
And just to return to Iraq, P.J. Crowley, I mean, it's costing, I believe, close to $6 billion a month, and it's worth noting that none of this money is budgeted or even debated, as I guess it's a supplemental, just like the money that's going into New Orleans. How much do you think, you can't help noticing sort of rumblings from the military, particularly from Army generals, floating ideas that they're going to be pulling out, wanting to redefine the war on terror. And I get the impression from interviews that I've done is that there's a sense that the U.S. military, particularly the Army and the Marines, who were rebuilt after Vietnam, many feel that they are being exposed, in effect, as a paper tiger here in Iraq, because we went in with this major military power, but it doesn't seem to have been intimidated. Our awesome technology and firepower doesn't seem to have intimidated or solved any problems. In fact, it appears to have done the opposite. You know, we've drastically illustrated the severe limitations of military force as a means of defeating, you know, terrorism, ideas, and passions. And we've given other potential enemies in the United States all over the world a free object lesson in how small and weak forces can torment, frustrate, and even defeat the lone superpower. In other words, in terms of asymmetrical warfare, have we not given the world the wrong lesson?
Well, I mean, I agree with everything you just said. That clearly, our leaders have been very candid lately in saying that military force cannot ultimately defeat an insurgency. Of course, you've got this odd other aspect, which is okay, but the answer is then to stay the course, which ultimately is not going to be able to defeat at least the Iraqi component of the insurgency, which is responding to the U.S. occupation as much as it's responding to anything. So yeah, that's true. I think clearly we see a military that is in stress. I'm sure, you know, you look at photos of the Marines literally coming ashore, you know, into New Orleans or in the Gulf Coast. Ultimately, the military response here will be extraordinarily formidable and extraordinarily efficient. You know, but I think that no doubt that the speed with which the military was able to respond, and the fact that the National Guard, in particular, where in another setting it might have more resources closer to the disaster. In this particular case, they've had to cast a pretty far-reaching web out to other parts of the country to get, you know, specific capabilities, because in many respects, the very same equipment, helicopters, large trucks, that are vital to war are also vital to disasters, and they can't obviously be in two places at once. So we're faced with a situation here where we have overseas obligations, we have domestic, what the military calls consequence management responsibilities. We also have this emerging mission, which is under what's called Homeland Defense, which is the military is responsible for the military defense of the United States in the event that a terrorism attack exceeds the local capabilities of local law enforcement, or certainly in a broader scenario, our ability to, say, to patrol the skies in the event we see another 9/11 aircraft hijacking kind of scenario. I think we have to step back and find out, you know, where's the balance here? Can an organization like the National Guard effectively do all three? And if we expect them to do all three, I think we have to certainly change the nature of the Guard, add more to its priority, perhaps bring more of its part-time soldiers onto active duty on a regular basis. We have to give it a broader set of equipment, raise its level of readiness. So there are lots of things that we are going to have to do, recognizing I think what we're seeing here is that we have a limitation in our ability to handle all of these responsibilities that occur in significant ways on a simultaneous basis.
But I guess in closing, P.J. Crowley, I think for the average American, it makes you feel good to see our soldiers giving these desperately needy people down in New Orleans food and water and rescue. Conversely, in Iraq, where they have a similar, or at least there's an attempt at some kind of humanitarian mission under the broad umbrella of bringing democracy, they're not welcome. In fact, they're being shot at. So do you think that this kind of subtext is getting into our consciousness here? I mean, aren't we all asking these questions about why are we spending our treasure and the lives and limbs of our boys and girls to this misadventure abroad, which is bringing nothing but grief and hostility, and exacerbating the problems we ostensibly went to solve. At the same time, here at home, we've just got an embarrassingly stark example of that there's an underclass in this country that is desperately in need of help.
Oh, no question about that. I would say that the key to our inability to do the kinds of peacekeeping or humanitarian or stabilization operations in Iraq is the fact that we've never been able to win the war. Going back to May of 2003, where the president stood under the banner that said "Mission accomplished." It wasn't. In effect, the war has never ended. In fact, now the war has been draining away resources that were originally designated for reconstruction of vital infrastructure, within Iraq, and that is the overall conundrum, which is things in certain respects may be getting better, but broadly speaking, the war is still intensifying. The insurgency is growing in strength, and that is the vital aspect and miscalculation. We never, ever were able to get on top of that insurgency. We left the door open, the barn door open, and out came this violence, and it's never stopped. So I think that is the vital aspect. Clearly, if we have to step back in the Iraq context and evaluate what we expect to be able to accomplish militarily. I think Walter Jones, Republican congressman from North Carolina, really did put his finger on it, which he said, I think we've just about accomplished everything that we can militarily. We have to broaden this challenge in many respects. If we're not going to win it militarily, we have to transition to other methodologies, including a reconciliation process within Iraq. We do, in fact, have to get a constitutional government stood up there. We have to bring in Iraq's neighbors to find a regional solution to be able to stabilize Iraq. We certainly can't do that alone. So, the military may still continue to be an important subdimension here in terms of the ongoing training of Iraqi security forces, but clearly what we're not seeing yet is a major effort to broaden this effort from being just a military first operation to something that incorporates more effective diplomacy, economic development, international coordination. There's lots to do here, and yet all the Bush administration has is this one, continues to play this song with one note, which is putting the military forces into the middle of it, even though we recognize that they will ultimately not be able to defeat the Iraqi insurgency.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, P.J. Crowley.
Ian, always a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with P.J. Crowley, who is a Senior Fellow and Director of National Defense and Homeland Security at the Center for American Progress, and he was previously the Senior Director for Public Affairs for the National Security Council under President Clinton, and he's a 26-year military veteran. I'm now speaking with Dr. Ari Kelman, who is Associate Professor of History at the University of California in Davis. He is the author of the prize-winning A River and Its City, The Nature of Landscape in New Orleans. And, of course, we've seen it's more of a waterscape now as we see these helicopter shots of a vast lake that was once a city with rooftops and the occasional person desperately waving their T-shirts on from the tops of the roofs. Is this a man-made disaster or a natural disaster?
Well, I think it's a good question and one that's rather easily answered, I'm afraid. This is very much the byproduct of poor planning, willful disregard for environmental limits, and perhaps even hubris. The city of New Orleans, of course, as we all know now, sits below sea level, sits below the level of the Mississippi River, sits below the level of Lake Pontchartrain at its rear. Over time, people have managed to keep the floodwaters at bay by building levees higher and higher. Unfortunately, the city also has a very, very high water table, in some cases just 2 feet below the surface of the soil. And so there's almost no natural drainage. As those levees have gotten higher and higher, the only way to get water out of New Orleans once it comes in is actually to pump it over the level of the levees. So when the levees break or the pumps fail, and a little of both, unfortunately, has happened recently in New Orleans, what you have is a real calamity. In this case, I think there's no question that even if Katrina, the storm itself, was natural, and the present state of climate science suggests that perhaps even that isn't the case. But even if Katrina was natural, this disaster, I'm afraid, is not. It is human constructed.
Well, but just in terms of the storm, you know, it was a relatively minor event when it crossed Florida, but then when it got into the Gulf, it went from a 2 to a 4. I understand that the temperature of the water in the Gulf was at an all-time high. So is there not some kind of climate change dimension to this?
Certainly a number of climate scientists are saying yes. I think that it's too early to know for sure. But even if we want to label Katrina an absolutely natural phenomenon, which again I think that's in grave doubt at this point, that doesn't suggest that the disaster was natural. This disaster was a byproduct, as I said, just of poor planning.
When you talk about poor planning and hubris, I mean, in 2002, a Category 5 hurricane hit Cuba.
Yes.
No one died. So why is it that the world's lone superpower can be exposed being so ill-prepared and such a tardy and inadequate response compared to apparently the way the Cubans handle it?
Well, I think that there are a number
of. And they're supposed to be a third world country, you know.
Yeah, I think there are a number of different ways to answer that. I think that, first of all, we suffer in this country from a what I would call a state of disaster amnesia. Every time we have a disaster, we seem to forget exactly what happened. And I think in some cases that forgetting is willful. And I think that's certainly what's happened here. There's no question at all. It's already becoming eminently clear that this flood in New Orleans was in no way unpredictable. In fact, it was predicted, and there should have been a better plan in place to deal with this. I think that Cuba has a much more centralized state apparatus, and I think that their planning efforts were unfortunately just far superior to ours in this case. I think the thing that I find particularly terrifying is that, as you said, this was only a Category 4 storm. As I understand it, by the time it had actually made landfall, it was somewhere between a 3 and a 4. And so this really isn't the big one for New Orleans. The big one's going to be a Category 4 or a 5 that's going to track just slightly differently. What happened here
What we're seeing now was only a really, as I said, an unfortunate byproduct of Katrina, but really of poor planning. If a storm tracks right up the mouth of the Mississippi River or over Lake Pontchartrain, then we've got a real biblical catastrophe on our hands. It's almost unimaginable that things could be worse than they are right now, but I'm afraid that they probably could.
Well, there are 4 to 6 more hurricanes expected in this season, right?
And getting back to the issue of climate science, some people are positing that unfortunately the Atlantic hurricane season is just going to be longer as the Gulf is warmer, and so we may have more than that even. I mean, I think it will just depend. Hopefully, we'll get lucky and we'll dodge what would be another bullet, but it's just impossible to say at this point, of course.
And it seems that like half of them go up the Gulf, the other half go up the Atlantic coast.
Right, right. And doing damage whichever way they go. As I said, disaster amnesia. We do continue to build in harm's way, but I don't think right now is the moment for recriminations on that front. I think that there's plenty of blame to go around for the people who did not have a more effective disaster plan nor disaster preparation in place. I hope that Gavin Newsom, I hope that that Antonio Villaraigosa are, and I'm sure they are, by the way, paying very close attention to what's happening in New Orleans, because I think that for cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco close at home, I think that, again, it's unfortunately not a matter of if but when there's going to be a disaster that we can only hope won't reach this magnitude. But one of the ways that we know for sure we can keep that disaster from growing this severe is if we've done better planning, and if we know what we're going to do once it does ultimately hit, once that earthquake does shake up those cities.
Well, obviously, we can't prevent earthquakes, but you can prevent levees breaking, and it turns out that there are a number of studies and a number of warnings that the Army Corps of Engineers have been defunded, and that a spokesperson for the Army Corps of Engineers, in response to questions about the inadequate levees around New Orleans, said that, well, we did a cost-benefit analysis. Well, hello. I mean, we're talking about, for cents on the dollars, the cost has to be a billion times worse than it would have cost you, or at least 1,000 times worse. A million times worse. I don't know. I'm going crazy with numbers here, but the long and the short of it is that for whatever millions it would have cost to raise that levee and strengthen it is nothing compared to what this disaster is going to cost.
Yeah, I think that what we're seeing now from the Corps, and what we'll probably continue to see for a little while, is an effort on the part of people who work for the federal government to try and cover their asses. And I think that it's an ugly byproduct of what's going on right now, that we're seeing that at various different levels of the federal apparatus. I happened to, it was a mistake, I should say, turn on the television this morning for the first time in several days, and I watched Michael Chertoff explain to me that there was no way to know that a storm like this could ever have happened, that this was absolutely unpredictable. And as you say, of course, the Corps, the Louisiana Levee Districts, civil engineers of a variety of different kinds, scholars and others have been saying that this is exactly what was going to happen, and that the levees in New Orleans, the interior levees, that is, now not the river levees, were only designed to handle a Category 3 hurricane. Well, now we see that what happens when a Category 4 does roll in. And for those people who were doing those cost-benefit analyses, I think that they have found that trying to boil these things down to simple economic terms doesn't work very well, and there are tragic consequences.
Well, when the Dutch built their system of dikes, levees, they had severe flooding prior to it. They calculated the worst-case scenario for a climate event would only happen once in every 10,000 years.
Right.
And they made that calculus based upon what they thought was a cost-benefit analysis,
right,
that even something that completely unforeseen is worth protecting you against, because if the levees or the dikes break, the costs are beyond belief.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we're hearing some of the language of flood control right now, and that language tends to break down to discussions that talk about a 100-year flood or a 500-year flood, and in many cases along the Mississippi River, the levees have been improved to the point that they'll withstand a 500-year flood or a 100-year flood. In some cases, they may be even better than that. The problem is that doesn't mean that a flood will happen every 100 or 500 years, of course. It means that there's a 1 in 500 or a 1 in 100 chance that it will happen in any given year. And so this is, again, I hate to keep on hammering this point, but this was something that many people knew would happen. It was just a question of when it was going to happen. And it was a question, I think, and this is perhaps the most troubling element of everything that we're seeing at this point, it was a question of to whom it was going to happen. Of course, the wealthiest New Orleanians have long since left the city, and all of them are in relative safety, leaving behind people who are impoverished, members of the underclass, as your previous guest suggested, to face this kind of a catastrophe. And there's a long history of that in New Orleans. The city's dealt with disasters, perhaps not of this magnitude before, though disasters that have had much higher death tolls. And almost always, it's the poorest and the disfranchised, the disabled, the people who aren't able to help themselves, who are confronted with the worst part of these calamities.
Dr. Aya Kelman, your book, A River and Its City, The Nature of Landscape in New Orleans, deals with the changed ecology of that region. It's several factors. One, the river, the Mississippi, has apparently for the longest time been depositing silt that's impregnated with pesticides from the vast breadbasket in the center of this country, which is addicted to chemical fertilizers and pesticides, and that the barrier islands aren't receiving, they're not being built up as they used to be.
Right.
And furthermore, the bayou surrounding New Orleans isn't the sponge that it used to be.
That's
to
right.
Soak up these hurricanes because of oil exploration. And encroachment into the bayous. So just run us through how much industry and development has interfered with nature.
Sure. Putting it as simply as I can, every time Walmart builds a new parking lot anywhere in the Mississippi Valley, and the Mississippi Valley, of course, stretches from as far west as the eastern slope of the Rocky Mountains and as far east as the western slope of the Alleghenies. So we're talking about a considerable portion of the United States. Anytime Walmart builds a parking lot or a new subdivision goes up that has a great deal of concrete, the valley loses some of its ability to absorb water, and that water ends up within the Mississippi River, which causes a great deal more water to flow toward New Orleans, raising the risk of disaster and raising the level of the river. Within the environs of Lower Louisiana, the southernmost point of the Mississippi Delta, wetlands historically served as a kind of reservoir for floodwaters. When the rivers would overtop their levees, the wetlands would absorb a great deal of the flood. That, of course, is no longer the case. You can talk about the bayous and the wetlands in the area surrounding New Orleans, or you can talk about New Orleans itself and say that what used to be known as the back swamp, a massive cypress wetland along the banks of Lake Pontchartrain, is now part of the city. It's parking lots and driveways and roads, and so it's no longer available to help sop up some of this water. It no longer acts like a sponge. So you've got residential and commercial development throughout the valley. You've got industrial development in the Mississippi's Delta, and then you've got urban development right within the confines of New Orleans, all collaborating, if you will, to make a disaster like this even more formidable and complicated to handle.
And Dr. Ari Kelman, what about the residue of from agribusiness in the breadbasket of the country? I understand that just off New Orleans in the Gulf there's a huge dead zone.
There is. There's a massive dead zone. And when I lived in New Orleans, I was there for about 2.5, almost 3 years. And used to spend a great deal of time walking on the Mississippi's levee, and people were very clear with me that you should never actually get into the river, that the levels of pesticides, but also the pollutants that were being spewed out from the chemical corridor along the Mississippi made the river effectively toxic. And shellfish from Lower Louisiana, which is an extraordinarily significant industry for that region, have very, very high levels of heavy metals and also of pesticides. It's a pretty frightening cocktail that they've created down there in the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, they didn't create it down there; they created it upriver.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a frightening cocktail that they have to deal with down in the Gulf of Mexico. Right. Though, in fairness, they do their fair share right there. As I said, along the banks between New Orleans and Baton Rouge is along the river, right on the river is a stretch of land that's for some people known as the petrochemical corridor, and other people call it Cancer Alley. You can find BASF and others with massive refineries and plants there spewing an enormous amount of toxins right into the river. It really is. I suspect most of your listeners haven't made the drive along Old River Road between New Orleans and Baton Rouge, but it's an absolutely staggering landscape. It's almost unimaginable. You have these immense factories and refineries hard upon the antebellum mansions, the plantations, and behind those the shotgun shacks that are still occupied by the working class, the poor, the underclass, in some cases African Americans. It's a very, very I'm at a loss for words to describe it. It's puzzling and magnificent and terrifying all at once.
And what about Dr. Ari Kelman, the extent to which continuing oil exploration is encroaching on the bayous? I understand that that's one of the main reasons why they're drying up.
That's absolutely right. I think that what you see is our ongoing dependence on oil and an effort to, in some cases, wean ourselves from foreign sources of oil, yielding catastrophic environmental results. And one of the hotbeds of that particular catastrophe is southern Louisiana, where the wetlands and the bayous are being drained, where they're losing the water that provides them with the vitality to serve as in this case a reservoir for floodwaters, but in others as some of the most significant ecological zones in the United States, places that produce a great number of, as I said, our shellfish, other flora and fauna as well. It's a problem that at this point seems insoluble, but I think really the solution is a matter of a real shift in political will, and I'm not sure that we're up to that right now.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Ari Kelman, spokesperson for the Democratic Party, Howard Dean, recently referred to the Republican Party as a white Christian party, and of course there were howls of indignation from Fox News and others. But the truth of the matter is that the Republican Party is largely representing white suburban people, and by contrast, the urban inner city people are either Democrat or off the charts. They don't participate. They don't register. So. Is there, and of course, Speaker Hastert suggested that perhaps they should bulldoze New Orleans and I guess rebuild a kind of giant kind of Walmart or something. But What about this some kind of new vision, some kind of optimism here in terms of reinventing urban space in this country?
Well, let me speak to a couple of different points that I hear you making, and I hope that I'll have time to do so, and if I don't, please just let me know. First, I would say that I do think that there are actually at least twin poles of anti-urbanism in this country. One is certainly from the Republican Party. We've seen Speaker Hastert. We've seen Michael Brown and Michael Chertoff all evincing this kind of strong anti-urban bias, and in part that's a byproduct, I think, of the fact that it's getting harder and harder to call this a natural disaster. This is where we started our conversation. When you can't blame this on Mother Nature and say, well, she's fickle, what could we have done? Which, by the way, they're still trying to do. You have to begin to say, well, who's responsible? Which people should we look at? And of course, the Republicans are in power in a variety of different strata of our government apparatus. And so they're, I think, justifiably anxious that the blame is going to end up right at their feet. And I think to a great extent, it probably should. That's not to say there isn't plenty of blame to go around. That's coupled with the fact that, as you say, urbanites don't tend to vote Republican. They tend to vote, when they do vote at all, overwhelmingly Democratic. And so the Republican Party has never been a friend of cities, and that goes back as far as its inception in the years leading to the Civil War. Unfortunately, what I'm also hearing, and this gets to your question of leadership and the issue of rebuilding, I'm hearing some rumblings from the far left, from the environmental community, which has its own strain of anti-urbanism, founded in response to the fast pace of urbanization in the second half of the 19th century. Environmentalism in this country and the environmental movement has always viewed cities as being somehow unnatural. I'm very, very hopeful that the environmental movement may, in fact, see this storm and this horrible catastrophe as the opportunity that it's been looking for to forge real ties with urban America. Somebody is going to have to, as you suggested, articulate a coherent vision for how to rebuild New Orleans, for how it can be a more sustainable city. I don't think we can expect the Republican Party to do that. Unfortunately, to this point, I haven't heard very many Democrats who have offered anything like an optimistic vision for the future of New Orleans. I think that the environmental movement may be the place to look, though I have my very grave doubts about the movement's ability to sort of retool on the fly. I know that the environmental movement in recent years has begun seriously to think about questions of environmental racism and justice, but this would be an extraordinary chance to say, we have the expertise in this country. We have people who understand urban ecology. Let's begin to think about how to rebuild this city that must be rebuilt. New Orleans has to be rebuilt for cultural, for social, and perhaps above all for economic reasons. Let's think about a way to rebuild it in a way that is more sustainable, that will work for all of us. And in the process, if the environmental community at the highest levels can figure out a way to do this, perhaps it will finally expand its coalition, making itself much more relevant in cities, making itself, in the process, I suspect, much more vibrant. But I think, unfortunately, we'll just have to wait and see if that's going to happen. Because at this point, I'm hearing far too many dirges suggesting that, well, this has finally finished New Orleans off. Now that the relief is beginning to reach the city, I think that'll start to shift. And I would suggest to your listeners that people are going to be stunned at how quickly New Orleans is going to rebuild. This is a city that has a long disaster history. As I said, disaster amnesia can be a particularly frightening thing. It can lead to further calamity down the road, but at the same time, sometimes forgetting has a purpose. New Orleans has an amazing capacity to forget these kinds of disasters and to move on. I think it will again this time. I hope I'm not being too optimistic when I say that I won't be at all surprised if people are down in New Orleans partying for Mardi Gras this year or for Jazz Fest. That seems difficult to imagine right now, but given what the city's been through in the past, let's hope that it comes to pass again.
Well, I sure hope they rebuild it like it is and not a bunch of sort of, you know, modern cinder block gingerbread condos and vast, you know, housing tracts and developments.
Well, I don't think there's much worry of that. I mean, I have to say one of the things that perhaps hasn't been getting as much play as people would think is that, as I understand it, and having spoken to friends who are very close at hand, the French Quarter is in good shape. I wouldn't want to say that it's untouched, right. but it's been untouched, virtually untouched by the flood. The French Quarter, of course, was built on the highest ground in New Orleans, as was the Garden District, the Uptown Garden District, which contains this extraordinary array of antebellum mansions that take your breath away when you're down there. And those parts of the city, I think, are going to be largely intact. Of course, they'll have a major cleanup to do, but they'll do it relatively quickly. I think what we need to worry about far more are the areas of the city that tend to be on lower ground, which is, of course, throughout the American South, where the poor live and people of color. I think that those are the areas that I think that probably Denny Hastert was talking about when he said that New Orleans should just be bulldozed. If he could bring a bulldozer down there, it would certainly be to the Ninth Ward.
Well, I'd like to see him on a bulldozer, and I'd like to see what's thrown at him, too. I thank you for joining us in Los Angeles.
It was my pleasure.
Bye-bye.
You have a great day.
Thank you. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Dr. Ari Kelman, who's a professor of history at the University of California, Davis. He's the author of A River and Its City, The Nature of Landscape in New Orleans. I'm now speaking with Steve Clemens, who's a publisher of the popular political blog, thewashingtonnote.com, and he's a senior fellow at the New American Foundation, and he's organizing a conference coming up on Tuesday that will be broadcast on americapurpose.org and carried all day Tuesday on C-SPAN. And, well, now that I have you on, Steve, tell us what the conference is about.
Well, greetings, Ian.
Thank you.
The conference is turning out to be quite a huge event. But what I've tried to do, in some ways people think it's sort of a Trojan horse notion, is that it's coinciding with the week of the fourth anniversary of 9/11. And we continue to be distracted in this country and caught in this morass in Iraq and trying to think about terrorism and drawn this way and that by the government's reaction to these questions. And nobody's really deconstructed terrorism, the kind of so-called war on terrorism, and begun to break it down into its component parts. And so this is an effort both to bring a genuinely ideologically diverse crowd together, but also to deconstruct this mythology and mysticism that's developing around terrorism and try to put something better and more cohesive on the table. And essentially, you know, to get beyond all the gobbledygook, we're seeing that police and military means on their own don't do anything. If anything, they reinforce a lot of the factors that drive the recruitment of terrorists and whatnot. And so we're really looking at trying to figure out how do you systematically integrate everything from thinking about genuine grievances out there in the rest of the world to more enlightened foreign policy and diplomacy in the United States and thinking about the economic dimensions and poverty issues in the rest of the world and trying to build that into something that could put America on a better track. And if the Bush administration would like to take our advice and counsel that comes out of the conference, that would be great. There's an eminent persons group, which Warren Rudman and Lee Hamilton are chairing, which is going to release a big roster of sort of guiding principles to think about terrorism. But we have everyone from, Madeleine Albright to George Soros to John Ashcroft, who's obviously not going to be with us ideologically, Tom Clancy, General Wesley Clark. It's a pretty star-packed crowd. But then we have fascinating public intellectuals like the famous blogger Juan Cole and Robert Pape, who's written about suicide terrorism and how it's related to the identity and the politics of humiliation. It's a very, very interesting meeting and a bringing of all these people together. So I hope it has a very good sort of progressive punch on this debate.
Well, you can't help feeling that there are some analogies here with the warnings pre 9/11 to the warnings about how New Orleans could not withstand a Category 4 hurricane. And I think
there are two key things there. One is people may go back to Ron Suskind's famous New York Times Magazine cover story on the sort of Bush world, in which lots of the folks talking to Ron said, we make our own reality. And this is one of the most arrogant kinds of comments that I've heard come out of any White House ever. We make our own reality. Well, to a certain degree, presidents do make their own weather, but they also need to respond to the needs and concerns of their publics, and they also need to have some sense of what's going to be coming down the future. And what happened in New Orleans is an absolute outrage. And what happened prior to 9/11, in terms of missing some of the plate tectonics of what was going on with our bases in Saudi Arabia, etc., was also outrageous. And so reality is gathering up a big storm, and it's coming to wallop the White House in the head, and we're all suffering for it, and many of our friends in New Orleans and Mississippi are suffering for it. But I think the second thing to remember in the question of looking forward is that, you know, we can't wait for this White House any longer. I mean, I think that at this point we really need to begin assembling a superstructure that can sort of can't compete necessarily with the appropriations and whatnot, but at least ideologically and with policy begin putting these important issues on the table. Katrina happened because the Bush administration, I mean, Katrina didn't happen because the Bush administration, but the failed response was a failure of leadership and a failure to understand what was coming by way of the levies and others. But it also happened because most of us weren't paying any attention to it either. And that's got to stop. We've got to stop giving a pass to these people because the consequences are so tragic.
Well, I mean, I think you could describe them as serial incompetence. I mean,
yeah.
We're talking about the ample evidence of prior to 9/11. They ignored everybody from Clinton and Sandy Berger and others because they dismissed him out of hand. They were only interested in selling Star Wars. That was a panacea for our security. You know, how clear is a intelligence briefing titled Al-Qaeda Determined to Strike Inside the United States? That was just tossed aside.
Yeah, we ignored Clark's warnings. We ignored Michael Scheuer. We ignored many of these other people that were out there. And, you know, it's outrageous. You may recall, you're in California, you may recall a conservative journalist named Bruce Hershenson. I don't know if Bruce is still around. Of course, he ran for Senate. And Hershenson, in 92, made one of the most outrageous statements I'd ever heard, and that was that in the aftermath of Hurricane Andrew, which, of course, was devastating, not as bad as Katrina, but it made massive, massive damage, and lots of people died as well, he said that the federal government had no right or role in providing disaster relief, that there was nothing that was constitutional about it, and that it was unconstitutional to be doing this, and that if California suffered some major natural disaster, California should reject all assistance and coordination and direction from the federal government. And what really bothers me is that the Hershenson vision is widely shared by a number of folks out there, and that is the vision that the Bush administration brought into these questions when FEMA began to get dismantled and demoted and pulled apart and pulled out of the sort of first responding disaster relief business. People don't realize that with all this discussion of FEMA, FEMA is a shadow of what it was in responding after Hurricane Andrew in 1992. And so that is because of Hershenson-like ideology that this administration implemented.
Well, it's the notion that, you know, everything can be privatized and
that's right.
The public sector doesn't have a role. And but essentially, rather than what's essentially happening is that the very wealthy and politically connected people in this country, the government serves them.
But, well, yeah, that's what happened on 9/11. The wealthy and the politically connected still got plane rides.
Well, you know, and of course, there's a cult developing of conspiracy out there, obviously with some good reason, because I don't believe that many of these questions have been answered about 9/11. I don't know whether you're going to be doing it on Tuesday, but the fact that there was none of the planes were, you know, none of the air defense was operating. There's still so many questions, and it has led to this notion that some of them, most of them, scenarios are absolutely absurd. But still, the questions remain.
Well, and the big thing is that the concept of the war on terror, it has created this kind of demon that if you attack it, you're automatically on the opposite side of the White House, or if you try to deconstruct or if you try and pull it apart. And that's why I think this conference is important. If it does nothing else but to put a couple of ideas on the table. I've been infuriated by Frank Gaffney's comments recently that withdrawing from Gaza is appeasing bin Laden, and that he's making the point that anything that may show up on a terrorist list is thus an illegitimate move for the United States to make. Well, the problem is that terrorists out there, and I'm no great fan, of course, of bin Laden or terrorism, the issue is that they exploit grievances, real-world grievances, that many people elsewhere in the world feel. And I'm frustrated by the fact that we've got people like Frank Gaffney and others that are trying to delegitimate good and enlightened U.S. foreign policy steps that would improve our security and standing in the world because of these other questions. So that's what I think this conference is going to do, and it's going to try to reframe and take this war on terror and hijack it and push it in a new direction that I think is a next phase in America's thinking about terrorism, so that it is more enlightened, makes more sense, and that the Bush administration's failure to do this becomes an embarrassment for them. That, I think it's the only way to do it, is both to ask the kinds of questions you're asking about 9/11, but to think more broadly and to do it in such a compelling way that the failure of the administration to move is embarrassing and puts them on the spot.
Well, they've had their chance, Gaffney and all, and Bush and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, and they've done nothing but create the opposite of their intentions. And in fact, we can see that the insurgency is growing relentlessly in the last 2 years, and that the America's terrorist families all over the world have been inspired and invigorated by the continuing failure of the United States to defeat and destroy this motley and lightly equipped ragtag insurgency in Iraq.
Yeah.
So they, as I say, their serial incompetence is about time people fired them.
That's right. I mean, what helped me, you know, what inspired part of this conference, there are various things right. that did it when I got going, but one of them was the famous Rumsfeld memo. Remember the memo that he wrote that got leaked?
Right.
Over, you know, that said...
There are no good targets in Iraq.
Well, I mean, what he said is maybe we're doing things that are creating...
Oh,
more
the metrics, yeah, yeah.
You know, what are the madrasas? I mean, it was the most introspective and thoughtful note that he hated having been leaked because it was an absolute critique and criticism, a negative criticism of everything the administration has done. We're doing is taking that Rumsfeld memo and taking it an iteration further and showing that everything Rumsfeld thought about why their strategy might not be working is in fact not working.
Thank you for joining us, Steve. I'm sorry we've run out of time, but we've got to go.
Excellent. Thank you, Ian.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Steve Clemens, who has a popular political blog, thewashingtonnote.com. He's also a senior fellow at the New American Foundation, and you can watch the conference on Tuesday all day on C-SPAN. This program and all previous ones are available at ianmasters.org, where we're also podcasting. I thank Lewis Vandenberg, the producer, Jazz Shepard, the engineer, Rusty Wynn, and Carol Kuth, the assistant producers.